sponsors. Welcome to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in the studio, and with no further ado, let's get right to our VIP line, our very special guest, Dr. Victor Davis Hansen, who is a senior fellow in residence in classics and military history at the Hoover Institution and a professor of classics emeritus at Cal State University, Fresno. I'm sure you've read his writing. This audience in particular knows Victor Davis Hansen quite well. And I was really caught by, well, I like everything that Dr. Hansen writes, but I was particularly caught by an article he wrote a couple of weeks ago. And I'm just going to read you the first sentence here. Barack Obama is a myth, our modern version of Pecos Bill or Paul Bunyan. What we were told is true, never had much basis in fact, a fact now increasingly clear as hype gives way to reality. So with that introduction, Dr. Hansen, thanks a lot for being with us here on Backbone Radio. Appreciate it. So let's jump into this article a little bit. You start off by talking about what Michael Beschloss said about Barack Obama. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, he's a very renowned presidential historian, and he announced to the nation on, I think it was on PBS, that Barack Obama was the smartest man to ever assume the presidency. I guess on the basis that he went to Harvard Law School. But if that were true, then we would expect a stellar academic record or straight A's from Columbia to get into Harvard or a distinguished scholarly article or a seminal book or a big professorship. That's what people do if they don't go into private practice. But there was none of that. Or maybe he was talking about a brilliant legislative career in the Chicago legislature or maybe in the U.S. Senate, but there was no signature. There was no signature legislation whatsoever. So whatever it is about Barack Obama, we don't know much about him. We never did know much about him. But we do know that he has an uncanny political instinct to make people feel comfortable about themselves, feel good about themselves. He's charismatic. He can speak well. But as far as an actual record of distinguished achievement, I just don't think there's any there.
So let me ask you sort of an impolitic question, if you'll pardon the pun. I mean, I say, and I don't mean it in a racist way at all, but if the junior senator from Illinois, with no particular record to speak of, as you describe, had been a white guy, he never would have gotten near the nomination. Now, you don't need to comment on that in particular, but do you think there is something about his race and about Kid Glove wanting to treat someone nicely because he is, in fact, the first black president that allows him to get away with, you know, being this international man of mystery?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've had people with similar experience reach the vice president. Dan Quayle is a good example. When he was appointed, nominated as vice president, he only had 2 or 3 years. And John Edwards is another one that had no more experience than Barack Obama. But they would have never made it to the presidency. And they hadn't done Barack Obama. They had inherited wealth, or in the case of John Edwards, he had talent as a lawyer, apparently. But in the case of Barack Obama, he had an uncanny instinct for making people feel comfortable about him. And you're worried about the word being allegedly racialist or something, but think of two very liberal people, Harry Reid and Joe Biden, and what they said of Barack Obama. Joe Biden said he was a quote-unquote clean black, and Harry Reid said that he was he could speak a Negro dialect when he wanted to. Otherwise, he didn't have to. And what they were trying to so clumsily, I think, articulate was that Obama had an ability to make a lot of so-called white people feel comfortable about their country, about themselves, without really dealing with the issue of race themselves. Or I guess what I'm trying to suggest is if you live in the Palo Alto suburbs and you voted for Obama, that made you feel good in a way that you otherwise might have had to go tutor in an inner city school or send your kid to a public school. But Obama realized that he was a way, a surrogate mechanism for a lot of swing voters, affluent voters, and because he didn't have a record to run on of anything, really, that was very important. There were some other reasons as well why he was elected in 2008. It was an orphaned election. There was no incumbent vice president or president running. That hadn't happened since 1952. The economy was bad. McCain lost his four-point lead in the Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers meltdown. People were angry at Iraq, George Bush, et cetera, et cetera. McCain waged a weak campaign. But a lot of it was that he was a blank slate, and he was a receptacle to which people put their own impressions, anxieties, expectations into him. And it was kind of a surreal time in American political history, because if you had a candidate today, let's say Mitt Romney today says, I've just made a decision that I'm not going to release any of my medical records, and I'm not going to release any of my university transcripts, and I'm going to renounce all federal campaign public financing of a campaign. The New York Times and the Washington Post would go wild. But when Obama did that, nobody even, it didn't matter at all. So there was an exemption extended to him that was normally not extended to other people.
Do you think that's changing?
I think it is, because you see he has a record now, and he's still running as if it's the third term of George Bush, but it isn't. And he's got, for all the bad months of 2008, that year still ended, I think, with 5.8 unemployment for the year 2008. Well, by 2010, which is, we haven't had the 2011 statistics, but 2010, he averaged 9.6 unemployment. He borrowed $5 trillion in 3 years. The GDP growth is anemic. We're still in a housing collapse. We've been downgraded with our credit rating. The national debt is up to $16 trillion. So we're facing massive cuts in defense. We're having a $1 trillion federal takeover of health care. He's gone after everybody from BP to Boeing. So there's a record now to run on, and I think that's reflected in the polls, that he's only about 50-50 as far as his approval and disapproval. And that's come way up, you know, the more people did not see or hear of him in the month of December.
What's your take? You know, there was a story that got a lot of play among political activists just a few weeks ago, where some reporters from Yahoo News somehow got on a Republican National Committee phone call in which the RNC was talking about not attacking Obama personally because people like him and they think that would be a mistake, and to, you know, not talk about him or his family or anything like that personally. And I still, you know, the fact that the guy has played, he's probably closing in on 100 rounds of golf now in his presidency, and they travel extravagantly, spending a lot of taxpayer money. I mean, should any of that matter, or do you think they're right to stay away from all of that and just focus on unemployment, unemployment, unemployment?
Well, I think that'll matter as far as consistency. Every politico has bouts of hypocrisy, but we haven't seen anything quite like Obama that ran on the argument that Bush's anti-terrorism protocol, for example, tribunals, preventive detention, Guantanamo, rendition, these were all crimes against the state, they were unconstitutional, they were unlawful, and he simply embraced them all. And he's given this litany of class warfare, millionaires and billionaires, corporate jet owners, at some point you made enough money, etc. And then he seems to, you know, enjoy Tony golf courses. He likes going to Martha's Vineyard. His wife likes to go to Costa del Sol. So these are all important contradictions that they're going to make them against every candidate. They didn't last time, but this time I think they'll have to. Because whether we like it or not, Obama has done one thing and said another. And the left, if you said to somebody on the left, if you said, for example, George Bush killed 262 people through targeted assassinations, Barack Obama exceeded that 8 times, what do you say about that? Or he kept Guantanamo. They don't know what to say about it. And that's just an example of the media gave him a total exemption from that type of scrutiny. And I have people in my family who are liberal Democrats, and if I say to them, Barack Obama is the first and only presidential candidate in the general election ever to renounce the public financing of a campaign. They don't believe it to this day. They just don't believe it. The media's never made it an issue. So,
interesting.
Yeah, I think those are going to be legitimate things to go after.
Dr. Hansen, we got to hit a break here. When I know I've only got you for one more segment. When I come back, you touched on a few seconds ago cuts in defense with the new defense budget that Barack Obama has brought out in the last week. And there's arguments on both sides. Are they huge cuts? Are they not huge cuts? And you're a military historian, you know, better than any that I know. So I want to talk to you about the significance of that when we come back after these words on Backbone Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky in the studio. Let's go right back to our VIP line, Dr. Victor Davis Hansen, who, among other areas of expertise, is a military historian. And so knowing that I had Dr. Hansen on the show, I was very interested to talk to you, Doctor, about Barack Obama's new U.S. defense strategy. On the one hand, Obama is saying the defense budget will be larger than it was at the end of the Bush administration. And then just a couple hours after he said that, the second-ranking official in the Pentagon, this is from the LA Times, came out and said, you have over the next 4 years a reduction in total defense spending as rapid as any we have experienced after Vietnam or after the Cold War. What's your take, Dr. Victor Davis Hansen, on what we're seeing with the defense budget?
Well, we have to remember that it grew about 9% per year right after 9/11, and then it's tapering off. So it depends on where you start the year to see whether it's growing or shrinking. But the president has outlined $500 billion in defense cuts, and the key thing to remember is that we do have two benchmarks across time and space. One is a percentage of the federal budget, and it's only 20% right now. And the other is the percentage of GDP, and it's still below 5%, or it's a little bit over 4%. So by historical levels of the last 50 years, we're not spending any more on defense than we ever have. So the idea that you're going to cut it is one issue. It's dangerous, especially because it's going to mean we're not going to be able to fight two wars if we have to. And then more importantly, the way you're cutting it, he's really targeting traditional ground troops on the theory that we're in an age of special forces, predators, commandos, etc. That may be true, but, you know, war is fickle and it's unpredictable. If somebody crosses the 38th parallel tomorrow in South Korea, you might want an army division. If somebody, we get another Milosevic taking over a European country, we might need a ground troop. So you really can't predict what the threat will be. There's some other issues, too, that people forget. About 75% of the defense budget goes on training, on manpower, education, skill sets. And as someone who taught in the public university system, I can tell you that when I saw a 21-year-old, 23-year-old come out of the military, they were much better educated, more disciplined, more polite than most of the undergraduates that are on student loans. So we had an institution that was really turning out debt-free graduates, if you will, who at 19 could park a $100 million aircraft on an aircraft carrier, whereas, and then the university system, we wouldn't let most of the 19-year-olds borrow our car. So the military is doing something right beyond just protecting us. And these are issues that just don't come up or they don't enter the mind of Obama. And the other problem is, of course, his outreach, reset foreign policy of reaching out to places like Syria and Iran and the so-called bowing, the apologies, all of that creates, whether it's fair or not, an impression that's a force multiplier of these defense cuts. And so it gives the impression, whether he likes it or not, that we're back to about 1979 with Jimmy Carter again, of somebody who's deeply ambiguous about the historical and exceptional role of the United States abroad.
If we tell the world that we are a nation that can fight one ground war, and if we have some, let's say, fairly adventurous enemies, then when you get into one ground war, doesn't that isn't that just an incredible, beautiful, engraved invitation for one of those other adventurous enemies to test us at that point when we've told them, here's the limit of our capacity?
Yeah, I think so. And remember that in about a nanosecond, we can think of all types of places that could heat up. Greece is bankrupt. NATO is weak. Turkey's ascendant. The Aegean is a powder keg right now. Cyprus could heat up tomorrow. The Serbian-Balkan situation is still quite unstable. Former Soviet republics haven't quite adjudicated their status. People are still worried whether the United States would protect Taiwan if China invaded. North Korea is still loony. Iran just threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz. North Africa is aflame. There's all sorts of things that are going on in the world in which people do not decide to take an action predicated on the sense of deterrence. In other words, China today says, I'm not going to go over and land in Taiwan, or I'm not going to send a missile over Japan, or North Korea says, I'm not going to shell Seoul, or Turkey says, I'll just leave Cyprus alone, predicated on the response of the United States, that they fear that we have such overwhelming power that they might pay a terrible price. When that ceases, fairly or not, then people become more adventurous. We saw that at the end of 1979 when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. There were communist uprisings in Central America. They took hostages in Iran. China invaded Vietnam. All of that was predicated on Carter's impression that for 3 years, the United States was a very different country than it had been.
Do you think that it's overly simplistic of me to think that my biggest fear for this coming year, or potentially the biggest bad story of the coming year, would be something having to do with Iran?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that the problem we have with Iran is everybody says they're crazy because it's this crazy thing to do to tempt the U.S. Navy. Everybody knows that. It's the most powerful navy in the world. But from their point of view, they're looking at a administration that was quiet when they had a million protesters out in the street that almost apologized over the Mossadegh incident over a half century earlier. That's cutting back on their military, that is deferred to the UN and the Arab League before it did anything in Libya. So in their way of thinking, there's a chance, and it's also under enormous domestic tension. It's unpopular. So in their way of thinking, maybe an incident might be wise. It might regain public opinion. The United States might be humiliated. Just because it seems so illogical to us doesn't mean it's very logical to them. These are the reasons that people do stupid things, like the Argentines in 1982 invading the Falklands, or Saddam going into Kuwait, or China crossing the Yalu River in 1950. They all can be, or Egypt attacking Israel in 1973. They can all be explained away as stupid, illogical, counterproductive, self-destructive. But if you go back and look at the messages they were sent and their belief that there was no longer any deterrence, and their assurance that there was more to gain than lose, and then that they start to make sense. And that's what worries me about Iran. And their way of thinking, it might make sense.
Me too. And we only have about 45 seconds left, so let me ask you for a quick answer on this. What do you think the chances are of Israel taking unilateral action against Iran if Barack Obama won't and they believe that there's a nuclear weapon there or about to be there?
I think 50-50. I think if Barack Obama is reelected, that within 4 years there's a chance, 50-50, that Israel will preempt.
Okay.
No doubt about.
Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, thanks a lot for spending time with us this evening. I really appreciate it. Great to talk to you. Great to read you, as always. People can find Dr. Hanson's work at Pajamas Media and at victorhanson.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
So when we come back, Fred and I will talk a little more politics. And again, congratulations to the Denver Broncos. What a great game by Tim Tebow. I was looking up some statistics. He passed for over 300 yards and only had 10 completions. So his completions was less than 50%, but more than 30 yards per pass. That was really incredible. Next Saturday, they play the Patriots at 6 p.m. our time. That's going to be incredible. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. We'll be right back.